I'm Mike Duran on today's Guardian Daily. Guilty of conspiracy to murder using explosives on aircraft.
I only wish that I could do this again, come back again and do it again, and just do it again and again until, you know, people come to their senses and realize how, you know, don't mess with the Muslims.
We have a sit-down chat with Felipe Massa, his first since the F1 accident that nearly killed him.
The doctor, doctor said 1 millimeter on the right, you could have lose your view. 1 millimeter here, you could have become, you know,
brain.
So
damaged.
I was very lucky.
The man jailed for throwing his shoe at George W. Bush is set for a hero's welcome on his release next week.
His old apartment was in a rundown corner of old Baghdad. It had power for 6 hours a day. He had 2 pairs of shoes, one of which he threw away.
We take a behind-the-scenes glimpse at the life of a Guardian correspondent in Libya.
You can ask all awkward questions. It doesn't mean that you'll get convincing answers. You do get answers.
And former Radio 1 breakfast DJ Mike Reed on the end of the Wogan era. First, a news update and paper review with Bill Overton.
The Conservative MP who complained about public pressure on Commons expenses has been demoted. Alan Duncan was Tory spokesman on expenses as shadow leader of the House of Commons. David Cameron has now sacked him from the shadow cabinet and made him shadow justice minister. Duncan had complained MPs had been forced to live on rations. He now agrees that his demotion is a sensible decision. The last Protestant paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland have agreed to decommission their weapons within 6 months. The Ulster Defence Association and a breakaway faction from Antrim have given their commitment to the independent decommissioning group. The head of the group, Canadian General Jean de Chastelin, said he'd already witnessed the decommissioning of arms and explosives by the other main loyalist groups, the Ulster Volunteer Force and the Red Hand Commando. The paradise South Pacific island of Fiji is accused of human rights violations by Amnesty International. The campaigning group claims the military-led government is becoming increasingly menacing towards people who oppose the regime, including journalists. It says the government uses beatings and arbitrary arrest. Also in the South Pacific, Samoa changed driving from right to the left-hand side of the road at 6 a.m. this morning. Car horns sounded and church bells rang out as the roads were crowded with vehicles for the changeover. Police man checkpoints to ensure safety as the island's state changed to follow the same rule as Australia and New Zealand. They're having a 2-day national holiday to celebrate. Back in Britain, Essex police say they've managed to put 200 extra officers on the streets by making savings in other areas. It would have cost £11 million, but they've cut back on expenditure like hospitality and now buy cheap supermarket petrol. Two stories dominate the morning papers: the conviction of 3 men for planning to bomb several planes over the Atlantic, and the divorce of glamour model Jordan. The Times and Independent say the 3 British Muslims were found guilty of a plot to rival the 9/11 attack on New York's Twin Towers. We call them the Lucozade bombers because they intended to use liquid explosives concealed in soft drink bottles. That, says the Mail, meant it was the plot that changed air travel forever. Since the security services became aware of the plan, there have been severe restrictions on bringing liquids onto flights. The paper describes how the bombers plan to blow up 7 flights from London to North America within 3 hours. The Sun says that's the equivalent of 7 Lockerbies. That paper and The Mirror equally excited, though, today by the fact that Jordan and Peter Andre start their divorce proceedings at the High Court. The Sun calls it tit for tat, don't miss the double meaning, because they're suing each other. The Mirror, however, claims the process should be quite short as the couple have already negotiated a financial settlement and custody of their children. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
We start today with the case which led to further restrictions for air passengers: the plot to kill thousands by blowing up transatlantic planes with liquid bombs. 3 men have been found guilty of conspiracy to murder using explosives on aircraft: 29-year-old Asad Sawa from High Wycombe, 28-year-old Tanveer Hussain from Leighton in East London, and 28-year-old Abdullah Ahmed Ali from Walthamstow, also in East London.
Well, I'm doing this because the reward, the big reward that Allah promised those who will step on this path and inshallah become martyred. And the best amongst those rewards for me is the guarantee of Jannah for myself, my family and those that are close to me.
Abdullah Ali in the warning video he made public. The 3 men were among 8 defendants at the 6-month-long retrial at Woolwich Crown Court, which has cost the taxpayer £35 million so far. 4 others, also from High Wycombe and London: Ibrahim Savant, Arafat Wahid Khan, Wahid Zaman and Donald Stewart White were found not guilty of the same charge. Another man, 31-year-old Umar Islam from Plaistow in East London, was found guilty of conspiracy to murder. The Guardian's crime correspondent is Vikram Dodd.
The scale of this is astonishing. Remember back to August the 10th, 2006. That's when these people are arrested, and we are 3 years on, and we've just got convictions on the central charge. And you'll remember that, and you'll remember that still to this day if you ever fly, because this is the plot. This is the reason you can't take more than 100 millilitres of liquid on a plane. This is the reason you've got enhanced security even after 9/11 at airports across the world. Don't forget, we'd had the 9/11 attacks which had hit America. Airport security had been enhanced. And this plot, said the Crown and the jury accepted it, was so ingenious it would have bypassed that enhanced security. The Crown also produced evidence accepted by the jury that these devices were viable. They would have gone bang. And some of the mock-ups of the device on placed on an airline fuselage shows it punching a pretty sizable hole, which if that had happened at altitude and with a plane flying as it does at the speed it does, well, it would not have been very pleasant to be inside, and it more likely than not would have caused the plane to crash. The scale of the investigation is also breathtaking. It involved virtually every security agency in the United States. The United States regarded this plot hatched from a dilapidated council flat in East London. This plot, which cost a few thousand pounds, this plot which used materials easily available, this plot was regarded as posing a major threat to the national security of not just the United States, but also the United Kingdom. GCHQ, the UK government listening post, diverted significant resources to support it as they tried to get eavesdropping assets directed at what they thought were the leaders or directors in Pakistan. The scale of it is just, you know, mind-boggling.
One of the delays in getting it to this stage was because the US and the UK couldn't agree on what best next to do.
Well, go back to the run-up to the people being arrested in August 2006. Everybody agrees there was a disagreement between the UK and US about when to arrest them. The UK wanted to gather more evidence for a criminal trial. That's the first thing. And second, they had some intelligence which made them think if it was allowed to run for about 48 hours more, they would get intelligence about the wider plot and other figures involved. The US wanted this plot disrupted as a lot sooner. I mean, we're talking about a matter of about no more than 10 days, about a week. In part because they've gone through the psychological trauma of 9/11. As one UK terrorism official put it to me, we had July 7th, which is bad. They had 9/11, which is immeasurably worse. They just couldn't take a risk. Two, the US, they rate the British police and the British security services, but, you know, the only certainty is having these people in custody. So they wanted it disrupted. What happens is that a figure in Pakistan called Rashid Rauf, who the Crown and terrorism officials say was a link between these plotters in Britain and the Al-Qaeda leadership in the frontier provinces on the Afghan-Pakistan border, he gets arrested by Pakistan about August 8th, August 9th. And when Britain finds out about this, they realise they have to arrest the people in the plot involved in the plot in the UK, because if they find out Ralph has been arrested, they'll either go to ground or they'll accelerate the speed of their attack. So you have this thing with Ralph. Now, some in the UK believe that, firstly, the US did this on purpose, knowing that if Ralph is pulled, the UK has to act. And second, I think a minority opinion has suggested that it caused significant evidence to be lost. Now, others in the UK counterterrorism community say it was a pain, we're annoyed at the Americans, but we didn't lose anything significant. And, you know, Scotland Yard, I think, were pretty much openly saying we thought this was the strongest terrorism case we've ever put before a jury.
The Guardian's Vikram Dodd. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, who's up, who's down, and where does Britain come in the annual report into global arms sales? The countdown at guardian.co.uk/world. Is the hostile bid on Cadbury's a sign the recession is over? We explain why it could be at guardian.co.uk/business, plus the sounds of a reconstructed ancient stringed instrument, the Epigonian. The tune is the ancient classic Come Again. More of it at guardian.co.uk/science. Next, a Guardian interview with Ferrari's Formula One driver Felipe Massa. It's just over 6 weeks since he was left in a coma after a piece of debris hit his helmet while he was travelling at 170 miles an hour during practice for the Hungarian Grand Prix. He tells The Guardian's Donald McRae about the incident which nearly killed him and whether he feels unlucky or simply lucky to be alive.
You know, you need to think in different ways. I think last year, I was not unlucky to lose the championship because of the last corner. Because in the last race was fantastic. I won the race. I did
absolutely
the best
could
I could.
What could you do anymore? Yeah.
You know, I cannot work for the other guy, you know? I cannot do anything. I was unlucky in many races that I couldn't finish. That's yes, you know, because of, you know, a problem in the car or some whatever, you know? Also Singapore, because of the fuel, you know?
Of course, that mistake.
This was something which, you know, took it away many points on the championship, you know. So, but because of the spring, I was very unlucky to have the spring on my face. That's yes, I think like this. But I was very lucky after, because the spring could have, you know, the doctor, every doctor said 1 millimeter on the right, you could have lose your view. 1 millimeter here, you could have become, you know.
Yeah. Brain.
So I was very lucky.
Even though you seem, as you say, the other crashes affected you more, will there still be a little psychological hurdle to face when you start in the car again?
Well, as I said, for me, you know, the worst thing which happens after the accident is to stay not racing, you know, if you're not driving. This is the worst
That's
thing.
That's the pain, yeah.
You know? But not something which is related to the accident. My wife asked me 10 times already, but you don't feel anything? I said, no. I mean, that's what I like to do, you know. If I don't do that, is something is going on.
Well,
the,
you know, you said to me in Bahrain, you know, when you were a small boy, you had, you know.
You know,
speed.
That's my life.
Yeah.
That's what I like to do, you know. So I really, really, you know, hope. And I really think that nothing will change to go back in the car and push the throttle.
I'm sure you will be
the maximum,
same.
You know.
But just as a wife, as Rafaela, in a way, she would never change your mind, I'm sure, because she knows you too well. This is what you do. But did she ever sort of say, maybe, Felipe, think a little bit about...
No, she was asking.
Yeah.
You don't think... I said, no. That's it.
There's no point, yeah.
Finish.
Yeah. And your mother... Same thing, she just knows.
My mother knows me already a lot, so she was sometimes looking and already thinking, but she didn't ask.
Felipe Massa talking to The Guardian's Donald McRae. Now to a modern-day David and Goliath story. Just replace the slingshot with a shoe.
Shukran Azira.
That's Muntada Al-Zaidi, the Iraqi TV journalist who, with only two pairs of shoes to his name, chose to throw one of them at the former US President George W. Bush. From the moment his size 10 skimmed past the president's head, Al-Zaidi's life was set to drastically change. First, the one-year prison sentence, but, on his release next week, the expected hero's welcome. This is a man who thought he'd be shot dead by US forces that day, but for which reality couldn't be more different. As The Guardian's Martin Chuloff explains.
When he emerges from prison on September 14, he'll emerge to a reception that he could not have expected. In fact, he did expect to go down in a hail of Secret Service bullets. Instead, he'll emerge to a new house, a new car, a shoe factory named in his honour, a someone sending a golden horse to him, many wives, health insurance, and money beyond his wildest dreams. He will go down as a modern-day Arab hero, and his reception across the Arab world is sure to be one of celebration, somebody that actually took on the system, did something which generations of leaders here haven't done, and just took it to an overlord. So he is looking at a transformation of his life.
So let's compare then pre and post prison, because you've been to both the one bedroom, the dingy apartment that he was in, and his new property, haven't you?
Sure. His old apartment was in a rundown corner of old Baghdad. It had power for 6 hours a day. He had two pairs of shoes, one of which he threw away, the other which was an old tattered pair, which is still in his old apartment. It's got a film of dust across it, a single bed, no pictures, and no furniture, not even a television that works. His new home in eastern Baghdad has been built by the owner of the old Baghdadia television station from where he once worked, and it's four bedrooms, a waiting area, a sitting room, a reception area, which is sure to be very, very busy in the next couple of months, all brand new and waiting for him.
And the shoe that he didn't throw at President Bush, the former president, that's worth a bit of money, isn't it?
You'd imagine it would be. There's been an offer of about $10 million from a Saudi sheikh for the shoes that he did throw. And there will be an auction, so we're told, for his other remaining pair of shoes, which, as I say, are in pretty tattered shape. I don't know whether he'll ever wear them again. He certainly won't need to. There's been a shoe factory in Turkey named in his honour, and plenty of shoe suppliers in Baghdad are putting posters of him outside their shop fronts. So the one pair of shoes that he did throw away, if he can get them back, they're going to set him up for life, as if he really needs them.
And all these offers of marriage, has he accepted any yet?
He hasn't yet. He hasn't been able to. He hasn't been able to communicate with anyone from behind his prison bars. However, one of his brothers is in contact with a Palestinian sheikh who has pledged on behalf of his tribe to send a wife across to Iraq as soon as he comes out of a prison. And that offer still stands, and there is a dialogue there. So it could well be happy days for Muntada in the very short term.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Hello, I'm James Randerson. I'm the editor of The Guardian's Environment website. And today we're relaunching as environmentguardian.co.uk. The idea is to showcase the range of our content better. So there's lots of new images and video and interactive guides, as well as the strong commitment to news that, of course, people come to expect. We're also really keen to showcase user comments. So we're going to really big up what you have to say out there. And part of that today is that we have a live Q&A this afternoon around lunchtime with David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary. He's talking in particular about the Copenhagen climate talks, which are coming up in December, but he'll also be talking about the 10-10 campaign, which he has personally signed up to along with the rest of the cabinet. The idea of that campaign is to encourage individuals and businesses and organisations to cut their carbon emissions by 10% by the end of 2010.
Still to come, here's a radio voice you might recognise on the imminent demise of Wogan's Togs. That's Terry's old geezers.
Tony Blackburn, Terry Wogan, Noel Edmonds, myself, you know, cross over into TV and therefore have to be presenters as well. And Terry's somebody that sat nicely across the pair of them.
Now, we try to give you a reporter's eye view on the developments in Libya. Ian Black is the Guardian's Middle East editor and has just returned from a week in the North African country. Back here, British media gives us a Western perspective on the events surrounding the release of al-Megrahi, compensation for IRA victims, and Saif al-Islam Gaddafi's comments on Gordon Brown's part in all of it. But what about the Libyan perspective? To start, I asked Ian what happens when you get the phone call saying you're on the next plane to Libya.
They are, on certain occasions, very keen to have journalists come and visit. And in my experience over many years, they will invite journalists to come to report on events that they want to show off. And of course, this year, with it being the 40th anniversary of the Libyan Revolution, this was a big one. And they made it easy for journalists to come. Visas were issued at Libyan embassies all over the world here in London, Libyan's People's Bureau, as one should say. And they were encouraging people to come and report on this extravaganza, which is what it was. They felt they had a good story to tell. It was about the achievements of Libya and the fact that Muammar Gaddafi is now one of the world's longest-serving heads of state, 40 years. Puts him probably number two after Fidel Castro, of course, and the Cuban leader's position is less clear in terms of his actual role.
But now that we've had this controversy about al-Megrahi, are you still welcome?
Well, what happened was that the Megrahi release came 10 days or so before the September the 1st anniversary. And of course, inevitably, it overshadowed it. It overshadowed it here in Britain and to some extent, of course, in the United States. In Libya, the emphasis, of course, was very different. In Libya, the emphasis of the official media, and there's only really an official media, was the return home of an innocent man who was the victim of a miscarriage of justice. And in terms of the Libyan authorities, it was a good news story. It was he came home, this man who is by all accounts terminally ill, dying, came home. And it sort of fed in, if you like, to the atmosphere of celebration of the 40th anniversary celebrations and the 40th anniversary events. And not only did it feed into it, but it was actively encouraged. In a country like Libya, where the media is distinctly not free, things don't happen by accident. So you saw repeatedly on Libyan television, broadcast and rebroadcast, the images of Megrahi coming home with Muammar Gaddafi's own son, Saif al-Islam.
And as somebody who's just come back from Libya, if you had asked maybe some awkward questions, what would the reaction be to those?
Well, I mean, you did ask awkward questions. When I spoke to Libyan officials, I tried to get to the bottom of what had gone on in terms, particularly, of course, of the controversy raging in this country over the circumstances of Megrahi's release. You can ask all awkward questions. It doesn't mean that you'll get convincing answers. You do get answers. And what was striking from the Libyan officials I talked to, and one in particular who was the man who negotiated the whole Lockerbie episode almost from beginning to end, was basically that Libya and Britain have common interests here. And I think that's very striking. Both countries, in both countries, the governments say, look, we want to draw a line under the past. We are friends now. We want to do business with each other. And nothing untoward has gone on here. This was a man who was dying. The Libyans said, had he died in prison in Britain, it would have had negative implications for the relationship. And we thought it better if it didn't happen. And that's their story, as it were, and they're sticking to it. And it's a mirror image, if you like, of the British government's version.
The Guardian's Middle East editor, Ian Black.
On the latest Science Weekly podcast, the physics of beatboxing. We discover why Twitter is turning us into insects.
An ant uses the rate at which it meets other ants to decide what to do.
And music for monkeys. It's all on Science Weekly from The Guardian.
Finally, a blast from the past, to coin a hackneyed radio phrase. The former Radio 1 DJ Mike Reed guests on Guardian Daily today with his thoughts on the announcement that Radio 2 TOGS have been dreading for more than a few years now, as Terry Wogan gives us a date for giving up the Radio 2 breakfast show. He'll be replaced at the end of the year by Chris Evans, but will take on a new weekend show at the station. Mike Reed spoke to us on the phone from his radio station, One Gold. I asked him if now is a good time for LTEL to leave.
I don't think any time's a good time to leave if you're enjoying it. You take a view yourself of what you want to do, whether you think, I've really done this and it's time to move on, whatever it is in life, if you feel there are other things you want to do. And I mean, golly, Terry is young enough and is alive enough and has enough verve and zeal and enthusiasm to do other things and many other things for years to come. So he's been at Radio 2 a long time. I mean, he was doing the breakfast show on 2 when I was doing the breakfast show on 1 and is still there. So he's, it's interesting that this change of blood occurs every 5 or 6 years, probably at Radio 1, sometimes even less than that. But at Radio 2, it didn't seem to matter. Like Jimmy Young, Terry Wogan, you could be there from the start and still there. I mean, Terry is one of the originals, 1967, still there and still doing well. It's in America. If you're a broadcaster or you're a DJ and you're good, you just you just carry on doing it. If you're good, nobody stops you. But here we seem this sort of perception at Radio 1, we better change. And I mean, I just left before the blood on the carpet thing. So Radio 2, so the wheels seem to move more slowly there, and people get time to know the presenters and love them.
So what about this youngish pretender then, Chris Evans? How do you think he'll fare?
Chris is a great broadcaster. I have every respect for Chris, like Terry. I mean, he's terrific. He won't worry about it, but the problem he'll be up against is the legion of Terry lovers that the media will whip up and say, surely you're sad Terry's going, isn't it dreadful? And it will be. And yes, of course, there will be certain listeners that will desert or will move or will say, I'm not going to listen, and then maybe sneakily give it a crack. But the thing there is, I mean, it's like the whether it's, you know, when Steve Wright came in and everybody said, oh, he's not right for Radio 2. But after a while, he fits in. Jimmy Young goes, it'll never be the same again. I'm never listening to Radio 2 again. Jimmy Young's gone. Jeremy Vine's now doing well. And so it will be, you know, things come to pass. Things move on. No one's indispensable, however great they are. You know, the Manchester United team change over the years. They're still great. The Chelsea team, the Arsenal team, players come, players go. You lose Cantona, you lose Beckham, but it still rolls on. So, you know, it will come to pass that Chris Evans will do a pretty good job on there. And 2 years down the line, people will settle into it.
Final question. If you were in charge of Radio 2, who would you have put in the breakfast show to replace Terry Wogan?
It's very difficult to know because it's, you know, I'm not picking the team there. I'm not sure whether there's anyone within that is good for breakfast, but they never seem to look without. I mean, so many people have said to me, why aren't you at Radio 2, which would have been a great place to be. But, you know, it's a strange animal. A breakfast show DJ is a very, very strange animal, a very unusual animal. You've got to want to do it. You've got to be good at it. You've got to like it. So it's a tough one. But it is certainly, Radio 2 are exposing themselves enormously. They're leaving a big gap in the market. They've brought the demographic to a much younger place. In putting Chris Evans in there, emphasizing and underlining that. So that leaves a big area for a commercial Radio 2 to come in and say, whoopee.
DJ Mike Reed. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Download tomorrow's from 8 in the morning. Producing today, Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.